Hello, dear listener. Before we start, just to mention that April is not only a month of sunshine and showers, but it's also worth noting some special birthdays. The artist Raphael was born on the 6th of April, Leonardo da Vinci on the 15th, and J.W.M. Turner on the 23rd. And there were two royal birthdays, Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II on the 26th, Prince Louis, the youngest son of Prince William, on the 23rd. Two famous actors, Charlie Chaplin, born on the 16th, and Jack Nicholson on the 22nd. And famous people include Brunel on the 9th and Shakespeare on the 23rd of April.
April the 1st, All Fools' Day, is well known, but some events you may not know. April the 3rd, the first cellular phone call was made in 1973 by Martin Cooper in New York. On the 4th of April 1949, the first zebra crossing in the UK was installed. 15th of April, the Titanic sank. 22nd is National Jelly Bean Day in the United States. And the 23rd of April is St. George's Day, our patron saint.
Well, here on Roundabout today, we have for April
an interview, some music, and a location quiz.
And a letter from our dog walker, and an article about birds.
And another roof over our heads story, and finally some more music. And so off we go.
Hello and welcome to Jennifer Meets, and today I'd like you to meet an exceptionally talented young author, Leah Heath. Watch this space. Hello, Leah.
Hello.
Now, I know you're at college at present and also a published author, but to begin with, I'd like to know where you were born and a little about your family.
Of course. Well, now I'm 17 years old and we live in Dawlish. My parents, they originally lived around Kent and moved down to Devon in about 2000. And then, well, my mum, she works as a midwife at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital. She's worked there for around 22 to 23 years.
Gosh.
Yeah. And my dad, I think he's retired now, but he is on the local Dawlish Council, and also he was a home improvements consultant for around 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then he was also a church pastor before that for 10 years, which I think is quite cool, actually, like different jobs he's been in.
Absolutely. Nothing like moving around. Exactly. Do you have any siblings?
I don't, actually. No. I'm an only child.
I know that feeling. Oh dear, well, knowing your mother was a midwife, I was going to say she could almost have delivered you herself, couldn't she?
Yeah, almost.
We won't go into that though. No. So that makes you, as you say, you're 17 now.
Yes.
And I think you are our youngest interviewee ever.
Oh wow.
Where did you go to school, and really what were your interests when you were at school?
So I went to secondary school at Timoth, so the Timoth Community School. And then for the sixth form, I went to Exeter College because I thought it would be nice to go to a different place. And Exeter is quite a big city around here, and just a bit more independence and a different step up from secondary school.
But when you were at school here in Timoth, what were your favourite subjects?
Oh, yeah. Well, I very much liked doing art subjects, so I took GCSE art and I found that really fun. But then I also like maths because I like the problem-solving aspects of maths, and there's always a right answer, and I really enjoyed how you work through problems, and it's just so satisfying when you get an answer. Mm-hmm. And then I also took drama for GCSE.
Gosh.
And yeah.
Did you do any local productions while you were at school?
I did, actually. I joined a local drama group called Dramatically Different, and we did a production of The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe.
And what were you?
Oh, I was Mr. Tumnus.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'd be a good wardrobe, wouldn't I?
Mm.
So,
Going back to Exeter, what made you choose Exeter? You've mentioned some of the things, but I think you thought it had a good Ofsted report.
Yes, it recently had received a outstanding Ofsted rating, which is obviously the best it can get. And that's quite incredible, I think. That means it's a good standard of teaching and everything. Mm-hmm. And what I study maths, biology and geography there as well now for my A-levels.
Well, thinking even more ahead when you're thinking of going to university, tell me about your application to, I think, four or five. What did you do to prepare for that?
Well, first of all, you have to write a personal statement, which is about 1,000 words or so. It's just about yourself and what have you done and what education you've had and why you're passionate about the course. And so I've applied to Bath, Bristol, Exeter, Birmingham and UCL in London.
Have you heard from them? Because you were still waiting when we spoke.
Yeah, I've only heard from four so far.
Only four.
And I'm waiting for UCL, but they normally take quite a while to respond.
Well, you're stepping giant strides ahead. But I have to ask you, what will you be reading when you get to one of these universities? What's your subject?
Oh, I've applied for civil engineering, actually.
Have you?
Yes.
My goodness. And as you say, you were interested in mathematics and the designing. And you quoted, because it's a legacy for the future.
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant aim to have. And how many people of 17 have any aim for the future? So you're very positive about what you hope to do.
Exactly.
Right, well, we've gone way ahead now. So I'm going to bring you back and whiz you back to the past.
Yes.
And what happened when you were in year three at primary school?
Well, we had this creative writing class and I really enjoyed English and just writing stories because you can use your imagination and just all imagine these made up worlds which are magical and fantasy, everything mixed together. So in the class, I really enjoyed writing a story. And then when I got home, I decided to carry on writing and I just wrote for about half an hour to an hour, just a starting of a story.
Wonderful. Well, that's a good way to go, isn't it?
Definitely.
Can you tell me a little bit about your story? Because later on I'm going to ask you to read the beginning of it. So what's the basic story?
So I originally wrote it and it's about this girl who finds a magic button in a park and she's transported into this magical world where animals talk. It's all green and it's all fields and it's just a very magical place and she just has an adventure there and she meets unicorns, which I'm sure everyone loves.
I haven't met one yet, but I'm going to when I've read your book.
Yes, it's all round fun really, just animals talking is so great.
Yes. Have you had a push me pull you in the story? Or is that another one I'm thinking of? When did you come back to it? And also, it's so beautifully illustrated, which I believe you've done yourself.
Yes. So after my initial year three writing, I left it for about a year or a year and a half. And I looked back at the computer one day and I thought that's actually quite a good starting to the story. So I just continued and finished it.
Fabulous.
Yeah, nice. And I showed it to my dad and he really liked it as well. And he was like, well, why don't we take it a step further? Which I thought was actually a really good idea. And I knew no one my age that was like a published author. Mm-hmm. So I thought, why not?
So you found a company online called New Generation and they wanted you immediately.
Yeah.
And so you were published.
Yes.
And then I understand you were 12 when your book was published and you were able to go around schools.
Exactly.
Tell me that experience for you.
Yeah, so when it was published at around age 12, I was able to talk to schools, mainly primary schools, and target the year like 1 and 2s.
Yeah.
And I went around and just like introduced myself and introduced why I wrote the story. And then I just read a bit of my story to them. And they obviously really enjoyed it. And it was a good experience to obviously sell the book as well.
Well, you have to sell yourself first, I believe, which you've done admirably, even when you came here. I learnt all about you.
Yeah.
And did you find that your audience were wanting to be like you and think, now that she's done it, I can do it?
Yeah, lots of the little children, they kept asking, oh, why did you do this, why did you do that? And I think it was almost inspiring to them, thinking, if she can do it, then I can do it.
I think that's a very good thing, because normally it's grown-ups who are presenting it, and there you are, not really grown up at all. So having done this, I know that you can buy the books at Amazon and Waterstones. Now you've got that underway, can we look forward to a book two? And what will this be like?
Well, obviously the original book, The Land of Magical Surprises, mm-hmm. goes into the land of the talking animals. So I thought, for a second book maybe, they could be the reverse of it. So the talking animals come to our world, and it would be their experience of our world and have an adventure in our world.
Would the humans be non-speaking in the reverse world?
I think they probably would be speaking.
Gosh. I think a few of my friends would wish that on me anyway. Right, well, we're going to move on and say, well, I know you've got a lot ahead of you this year with your mock exams. Yes. And then will you take a gap year?
Not a gap year, because I think to use my time effectively, going straight into university would help, so I'll just get a kickstart into the job.
Mm-hmm. I think that's excellent. Can't wait to go, can you? Well, before we leave, I have to ask you for your choice of music and of why course. You chose it.
I've chosen The Dancing Queen by ABBA. It's just such a fun song, and it's lively, and it reminds me of the summer. And of course it's the Dancing Queen, she's 17, and that's my age as well.
Oh, what more could we wish for? Well, I look forward to listening to it, and probably we'll do a little dance. But next, I'm presenting you with my copy of your book, which you've kindly signed, and I'm going to ask you to read just the beginning, couple of pages.
Here we go. After tea that day, she got into bed and soon fell fast asleep. Rosie woke up bright and early the next day, feeling quite excited, even though she didn't know why. She ran downstairs for breakfast. Mum and Dad had already put the cereal, milk and spoons on the table. Rose sat down and ate her food, as if she was starving. When she had finished her breakfast, she asked to go to the park. Her mum said that she would take her after she had cleaned her teeth. They soon had their coats and shoes on and went to the park, chatting all the way. When they got there, Rose sat down on a bench, as she was a bit puffed out. Rose put her hand under the seat and felt something bumpy with her fingers. She bent down to see what it was. It looked like a button. She thought she would give it a press, even though she thought it wouldn't do anything. But to her surprise, the button started to glow, and she felt rather funny and floaty. Suddenly, as if it was a second, she felt like she was flying through the air. She wondered where she was and what happened to her. And where was her mum? She called out, "Hello? Hello?" No one replied, and no one could be seen. She felt a little nervous and frightened at this point, thinking, "What should I do? And where am I?" Rose thought she should investigate the area and looked around, trying to think which way to go. Then, out of the corner of her eye, not too far off, she saw a big oak tree, so she headed towards it. As she started to walk towards the tree, three excited rabbits came running up to her. One of them, whose name is Harry, jumped right in front of Rose and stopped and looked at the rabbit and said, "What are you doing? I nearly fell over you." But to her surprise, the rabbit spoke to her. "We have come to see who you are and where you've come from," said Harry. Rose jumped with surprise as the rabbit spoke. "How is it that you can talk? What a funny place it is here." "We all talk here. This is the land of surprises," said the rabbit. "It's a surprise to me as well," said Rose. "My name is Harry," said the grey and white rabbit, who looked rather smart and intelligent. "What's your name?" "My name is Rose, and sometimes my friends call me Rosie." "Can I introduce you to my friends?" asked Harry. "Oh yes, that would be good," said Rose. "This is Jess, my sister," pointing to a white and fair-haired rabbit. "How do you do?" said Jess. Then Harry pointed to the other rabbit, who was almost white apart from a little bit of ginger hair on her back and ears. This is Petal, our friend. Petal also said, how do you do? Would you come to me to trees, as I don't know where I am going? Asked Rose. All the rabbits said at the same time, we would love to.
Thank you very much, Leah. Really whetted our appetites.
Yes.
And I'm going to let our listener into a secret, because you have two rabbits. And what are they called?
I sure do. One's called Harry, which you can obviously hear is in the book. And
yes,
one of them's called Hazel.
Oh.
Yeah, unfortunately, Harry died in the summer.
Oh.
But at least we can remember him in this book. It's quite a nice reminder of
perfect.
Him.
Perfect, perfect. Well, I see we're a bit over time, so I'm afraid we now have to say together to our lovely listener, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Certainly got our toes tapping. Now, here comes something to make you think.
Hello, Fran Frank again with another of my Where Am I series. Being a beautiful but crisp sunny day, I've brought the car to a local village and parked in a small car park situated within an estate of pastel-coloured houses. Coming out onto the main road, I turn left and then immediately right, onto a narrow road alongside a wide stretch of water. The building on the corner is quite austere and in some lights can appear nearly black. As I enter this part of the village, a narrower lane with glimpses of the river. About halfway along, there are a pair of wooden gates with a grill through which I can see a rather splendid garden with a subtropical feel. To the left of the gate, there is a notice board indicating what the property provides for visitors. But the board itself is also interesting, as there are two rather fierce-looking fish curling over the top of the board in shades of green and blue, which are made out of pottery. Moving along, I eventually emerge from the lane and see a number of people sitting outside a local cafe, formerly a ship's chandlery, enjoying the view over the estuary. During my refreshment break, I notice a couple of people coming out of one of the purpose-built beach huts, now used as self-catering units. Once I finish my coffee and cake, I amble along the road towards a queue of people waiting for the local ferry. Today they are able to line up in the sunshine, but if it were to be inclement weather, there is a shelter provided at the edge of the beach. The structure is built of brick up to about waist height, with large glazed windows and covered by a pitched roof, with one side of the building open to the elements though. However, if you use it, it does give a good view of the boats as they move in and around the estuary. Turning away from the beach, I find myself strolling through some more narrow lanes and wonder how people get their cars in here. And even more intriguing, how do they get furniture delivered? As I cut through one of the narrow passages, I find myself in an open space surrounded by a totally different type of property. These appear to be more regular in size and shape and are painted in pastel shades including pale blue, pink and green. On the opposite side of the green is a local hotel where light lunches and some very nice evening meals can be had. To my right, I can see a stone pillar surrounded by poppy wreaths and pots full of flowers. At the top of the tower is a clock, which reminds me that my parking is due to expire. Where have I been? I'm sure a lot of you living alongside the River Teen would have recognised Sholden as my destination. The austere building on the corner is St. Peter's Church, built between 1895 and 1902. The vicar at the time had seen a similar structure when travelling in Italy and asked a local architect to produce something along the same lines. The sign, which I described with two fishes, advertises accommodation at the Potter's Mooring, and the cafe where I took my morning refreshment and enjoyed the views over towards Tynmouth was, of course, the Clipper. Having wandered through the back streets, I ended up at the Bowling Green, where the clock tower stands. The structure was built in 1921 in recognition of the end of the Great War and also to remember the men of the village who lost their lives during the conflict. Although spring has yet to arrive, it was a very pleasant stroll through one of Devon's unspoilt villages. Bye for now.
Did you get it right, Aileen?
No.
Well, now we have another book review for our readers, Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor.
Well, this month, Mary and I have been reading a book that I just love. It's one of the books that I read in the last year or two that I have most enjoyed. It's called Light Perpetual, and it's by Francis Spufford. So the premise of this book is that it starts in 1944, in the middle of the Second World War. We're in South London, and there is a department store, and a V2 bomb, German V2 bomb, is heading towards the department store, and it explodes and kills, I think, about 150 people who are shopping there on a Saturday morning, and that includes some children. This actually did happen. This is a real event. And what Francis Spufford has done in this book is asked himself the question, what might have happened to five of the children had they not been killed that Saturday morning, but had they had a full life through the second half of the 20th century into the 21st century? And it's really the story of their lives, and it's a story about London as much as anything else.
And also, with Stephen and I doing it, you've got two viewpoints. You've got me, who is of the age of those children when they're older, completely grown, and a younger man who's looking at it from a different perspective. I felt at first that I wasn't going to get into it, but I did. I got to know the characters, to feel a bit more for them as it processed through the reading. And eventually, I have to confess, I did end up enjoying it. But what really fascinated me at the very beginning was the minutiae of this bomb coming and all the chemical reactions and the very millionths of seconds that it encompassed. It's not something I ever had heard about or come across as a child, because I was born towards the end of the war, so all I saw were bomb sites. But that experience, reading it like that and knowing it was a famous, well-known store, and that it's true, I always like a bit of it's true, but it helped me to view the whole situation of those growing children and the traumas that hit them all.
That's right. Well, it's really about five very ordinary lives. The two girls who are twin sisters, and then three of their male classmates. And it revisits them every 15 years. So it's not the complete story of their lives. It's like little flashes. We kind of dive in and visit them at 15-year intervals. So they start when they're, what, 5, 6, and they end up in their early 70s, I guess. And they have very, very different lives, but none of them achieve outstanding things. None of them are extraordinary in every way. They are ordinary everyday lives with the normal ups and downs that we all have, sadnesses, triumphs, nice things, less nice things. Some of them are much more attractive personalities than others. Some of them kind of redeem themselves after they've had some rough patches and so on. And it really is a celebration of ordinary British life in the last 7 to 8 years. And I just thought it's done so beautifully. I think the opening paragraphs with the bomb heading towards the store are just extraordinary, just as a piece of writing.
Really,
and personally,
yes.
I find the closing section, which is one of the characters is dying and it's his last thoughts, I think it's so beautiful. Marvellous. I am fantastically written. I just love this book.
I have to say, it is very nicely written. It's got a good flow to it. I hadn't got that sense of having to refer back to match the character 15 years ago with the current one, and along with that. But yes, some of the characters were totally sympathetic, and the outcomes for some were brilliant, and outcomes for another was, gosh, I'm so pleased. But yes, lots of highs, lots of lows, as in normal life, and also in periods we tend to go 10, 15 years before the great things in our lives happen. And when you look back, you think, really? Did I manage that? And you get to the end. And that's how it was with this book. All these characters came to a rounded end for the reader.
Oh, another one to add to my list of books to read. Well, now we have another fascinating look into life with Honey Bear. Oh, and Aileen Clarkson.
Dear listener, for what seems like weeks, it has been wet underfoot, wet overhead, wet clothes and wet dog, and that is just walking up the road. Once at our destination, generally Mews Park, Oaklands Woods or Dawlish Crantry Park, wet changes to mud. There was a muddy dog in the back of my car yesterday. I had checked the internet site AccuWeather, which is usually accurate, but not that morning. It told me that for the next 120 minutes, 2 hours, no rain was expected to fall in either Dawlish or Tynmouth, and on the strength of this, Honeybear and I had driven to Dawlish Country Park. The sky was all overcast, but it's been like that for many days, wet or dry. We ambled to the upper field and turned right towards the wind turbine located beyond the park somewhere in Dawlish Warren. Luckily, I had decided to wear my blue wellies and raincoat, but Honeybear was clothed only in recently clipped fur. Suddenly the rain started to fall with great large drops, which were coming straight down and bounced when they reached the ground, making any attempt to shelter useless. As you can imagine, by the time we got back to the car, both of us were bedraggled and somewhat muddy. Thank goodness Honeybear is really good when it comes to paw cleaning and sits or stands patiently until I have finished. This letter risks sounding like a weather report, but I can tell you that today the sun is out and there is only a few fluffy white clouds in a blue, blue sky. Mews Park and a stroll along the seafront is where we intend to walk early this afternoon. I may have mentioned that I like to play canasta, Australian canasta, which is a card game usually played by four people using four packs of cards. If the host has a friendly dog, Honeybear is sometimes invited to accompany me, and she is happy to lie on her rug nearby or play with the other dog. I recently spent the afternoon in a beautiful home in Sheldon, where Honey and Pip, the resident spaniel dog, whom Honey had met several times, spent a comfortable afternoon together. It is my turn to play host this week on Sunday afternoon, and although there are no dogs expected, I know Honey will welcome the visitor's company. A girlfriend who lives in Bishop Stainton enjoys writing short stories and theatrical plays. I greatly enjoyed one of her one-act plays, splendidly enacted by the Bishop Stainton Amateur Dramatic Group, to a full house in the local village hall. It is amazing the diverse talents and interests of my friends. Art, flower arranging, singing, playing the ukulele, gardening, quizzing, writing, owning a racehorse, cruising, unusual worldwide travel, participation in Here and Now and roundabouts, and these are just a few interests which spring to mind. When the clocks went forward to summertime and we lost a whole hour on the 26th of March, my inner clock did not adjust immediately, and I have only recently welcomed the alarm sounding just before 8. Honey, however, has had no problems with the time change. She's a very adaptable dog and doesn't fret if her food is a little late or I alter the time for her long walk. She just fits in with whatever is on offer, and if there's nothing happening, she retires to one of her many beds, safe in the knowledge that I haven't forgotten her. On a recent walk in Mews Park, we met a group of people who were curious to know what the bushes with no leaves and white blossom were called. One of the group had Googled on her mobile phone and received the reply that it was plum blossom. I was able to tell them that the bushes were, in fact, blackthorn, and I had discovered this a few years ago from someone I had spoken to in the park. The blackthorn blossom is everywhere, and truly looks as though snow has fallen on the bushes. The petals will fall soon, and fresh green leaves will coat the branches, masking the very prickly thorns. As I write, Honeybear is lying on a nearby chair with her head resting on the arm. She is watching, waiting for me to finish, so that we can go for our walk through the park to the sea. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
From Dogs to Birds with Valerie Forrester.
Hello, this is Valerie here. I'm just going to quote to you a lovely little paragraph in the British Trust for Ornithology's recent magazine. And it is written by Lottie Rowedder, who is sharing her experiences. And I thought you might find this interesting. It's called Smoking Jackdaws. The course culminated in a group research project, which gave students the opportunity to design our own experiments, perform our own data collection, and write up a report of our findings. Our group was inspired by corvid intelligence, in particular behaviour involving parents bringing cigarette butts into the nest, which has been shown to deter parasites. We therefore decided to do our project at a local jackdaw colony, which was monitored by one of our lecturers. This involved checking nest boxes within the colony, as well as looking at photos of nest material in past years, in order to investigate whether the presence of cigarette butts had an effect on clutch survival. We found no significant difference, but average survival was slightly higher in nest boxes with cigarette butts incorporated into the nest material. This project was really fun to be involved in and raised interesting questions about the use of anthropogenic material in garden bird nests. It was also fascinating to observe the jackdaw chicks and watch the development of this intelligent garden bird. Thank you. Bye.
Dog ends to birds? John Townsend is here next, with a second in his stories of roofs from his amusing series.
You may recall I recently invited contributions to A Roof Over Our Heads, to share stories about places we once called home. No doubt many of us have lived in all manner of spaces and shared the roof over our heads with all sorts of people, animals, and maybe unwanted creatures or things that go bump in the night. So, as well as inviting you to share memories of the interesting, challenging, or amusing spaces where you have chosen or being forced to lay your head, let me tell you about more of my lodger tales from when I was a student. I have so many fond memories of Madame Bevere, my French octogenarian landlady, and will always be grateful to her and the 3 years I shared in her home. In our second year at college, students had to live off campus in the big wide world. The accommodation officer issued us with lists of properties available and said to me, "We've just had this one come in. It has to be a single male, tidy, quiet, polite. The landlady is very fussy about that. It might suit you. We haven't used her before, and it's a lovely Victorian house in a most salubrious part of town. You'll have to be on your best behaviour if you'd like this one. There was a definite twinkle in her eye, and I sensed this could be an interesting challenge. When I arrived in Park Road for my interview, I was stunned. Beautifully elegant houses with large bay windows stood behind manicured lawns in a private tree-lined road opposite a park of elegant gardens and mature trees. It was more than posh. Number 36 displayed a stunning flower arrangement in a front window, and as I lifted the brass knocker on the polished black front door, I could never have imagined who was about to invite me inside. She was a tiny, white-haired woman, immaculately coiffured and stylishly dressed. Her sharp blue eyes looked me up and down severely. "You must be Jean. Come in and let me ask you questions." The hallway floor was beautifully tiled, with an Oxford University rowing oar mounted high above. She watched as I read the names inscribed on it. "My husband was a keen sportsman and schoolmaster when he was alive. We were married in 1927. I will talk to you in the drawing room, the only time you will be allowed inside, as it is strictly out of bounds. I have never had a lodger before, but first I must decide if I like you." I knew in an instant I would have to mind my P's and Q's with this lady. After being grilled in the drawing room, I was led up the staircase onto the landing. She pushed open one of the five doors to reveal a beautiful bedroom with fireplace, a desk in front of the bay window, and various chests of drawers. The room was larger than anything I had lived in before, and the view over the park was stunning. "I don't get up early," she said, "so you would have to get your own breakfast and eat in the dining room. I make my own marmalade, and it's very good." Like Paddington Bear, I can't resist proper marmalade. I was already hooked. She smiled for the first time. "You seem impressed. But I have standards. I may be prepared to accept you. That's if Blackie and Whitey like you." Fortunately, her two cats, although somewhat aloof, didn't seem to disapprove, so I was deemed acceptable. Yet the day I moved in didn't go well. I put my suitcase on the bed and was severely reprimanded for disrespecting the silk bedspread. The ultimate sin was grilling a kipper for supper. Not only did it send the cats crazy, but the smell permeated the whole house, just as ladies of the Conservative Party were arriving for drinks in the drawing room. A public telling off and disapproving looks all round left me in no doubt. I was a disgrace to genteel suburbia, with my fishy whiff of un-Tory subversive mischief. There was no lock on the bathroom door, so we had narrow escapes from walking in on each other mid-bath. Using my calligraphy skills, I made a posh sign to hang on the door handle declaring vacant or engaged. Madame B was so chuffed with it that she brought friends round to see it and to note how tidy my room was. I was slowly winning her round, but by my pièce de résistance came midsummer when I saw smoke rising from her greenhouse attached to the back of the house. To protect tomatoes from the fierce heat, she had draped heavy black curtains under the glass. These had slowly smouldered in the scorching sunlight before igniting and belching smoke. As soon as I announced, "Oh, it looks like the greenhouse is on fire," she ran outside, climbed a ladder, and threw down the blazing fabric. I hurled each one clear, only for them to land on her beloved lawn to burn blackened patches. However, I was her hero from then on, and could do no wrong. I was even allowed into the front drawing room on special occasions, or to join her in her back parlour to listen to her radio. There was no television. Each night on my return from college, she would invite me for a cup of cocoa and a good chat, often telling me about growing up in Bordeaux in the 1890s, including one horrific tale of her mother taking her tonsils out with a pair of pliers when she was a girl. "It must be why I'm as tough as old boots today," she chuckled. "My doctor tells me so anyway." Apparently, he had to test her grip when she needed to renew her driving license. He held up both forefingers for her to grasp, and she practically wrenched them from their sockets. "Oh, it was frightfully funny," she giggled. "The poor man was in agony." Even so, I wasn't sure she should be driving. Once she insisted on taking me to the railway station in her Morris Minor Traveller. Even though she had a plump cushion on the driver's seat, she could hardly see over the dashboard, and when pressing her foot on the clutch, she disappeared completely under the steering wheel. I was petrified every time she changed gear, not least when she decided to do a three-point turn mid-traffic on the bypass. I could only close my eyes in sheer terror. By now we were getting on famously, so I decided to stay on rather than return to halls of residence. Other students came and went in another of her spare rooms, but I seemed to remain her blue-eyed boy. One evening, she ushered me into her parlour with, "You won't believe what I found under the beastly youth's bed." The beastly youth was who she called a frightfully scruffy, long-haired music student. She was waving at me what I can only describe as a top-shelf magazine. Flicking it open, she held up each naked image. "I ask you, what does she look like here? I wouldn't call that elegant, would you? And look at this one, totally tasteless." "Oh, yeah, I see what you mean." I was well out of my comfort zone. "And look at this one. Well, we wouldn't have this in France. What do you think of that?" "Oh, good heavens," I spluttered. Shall I put the kettle on?" Needless to say, the beastly youth never knew his smutty magazine was used to light the next day's fire, and he never tasted her wonderful marmalade again. After 3 years with Madame B, I sat my finals and then moved away. A couple of months later, I returned for the graduation ceremony, where Germaine, as I now called her, joined my parents and me at the Sheldonian, and afterwards for a posh lunch at the Randolph Hotel. She was one of the family. A few years later, I attended her 90th birthday party and was now one of her family. The drawing room was now all mine. I shall always remember Germaine with great fondness, never more so than when making my own marmalade in the way she showed me. The aroma of bowls of soaking oranges and lemons bring those times right back. As she might say, à la recherche du temps perdu. So if, like me, you have particular memories of past homes or of characters from where you once lived, by all means tell us your stories. Maybe the next A Roof Over Our Heads will take us to yet another time and place, far beyond the here and now.
Oh, I wonder, John, where you'll take us to next time. To close our April programme today, we have The Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini by Sergei Rachmaninoff. Did you know he was born 150 years ago on the 1st of April?
As the Rhapsody is so long, there are 24 variations, we have chosen to play Variation 18 for your pleasure. To finish today, we'd like to thank Jennifer and her guest Leah Heath, Fran Frank, Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor.
And thank you too, Aileen Clarkson, Valerie Forrester and John Townsend.
And for those behind the scenes, Diane Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and distributing the USB sticks, Sarah Williams for uploading to the website.
The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor. So sadly from both of us for now. Goodbye.